We Talk Podcasts is now proudly presented by Geek Nation Tours. The time of the geek is at hand. Geek Nation Tours provides fun and unique vacation packages featuring themes such as the Civil War, Harry Potter, board games and beer, sports geeks, in locations such as Germany, Japan, England, and all over America. Visit geeknationtours.com and get your geek on.
We hope you enjoy your stay. It's good to have you with us, even if it's just for the day. We hope you enjoy your stay. Outside the sun is shining, it seems like heaven ain't far away. It's good to have you with us, even if it's just for the day.
All right, well, this is a brand new format for the Calgary Creator Summit. We've expanded into greater than just the Calgary area with new Canadian, yay, Alex Bimbo. Great to see you here.
Thank you.
Love you. Traveled in. So we're going to start with going around the table. We're going to do a couple of these with a mixed group. So maybe do a long intro this time, and then you can do a shorter one next time. So they don't, but it, people will have to hear your voice each time, so they actually know who's talking. So I'm the co-host of We Talk Comics, Keith.
I'm Jackie.
So your name and what you've been doing that got you into this mess.
Distinctive comedy voice so that we can all tell who is on the recording.
Okay. Alexander has already affected an accent. That's
I'm very bad at accents. my name's Jackie Huskisson. For the past 6 months, I have been doing my MFA over in Ireland. I came back home for Christmas. I'm mostly a printmaker, but I do a lot of comics as well, a lot more independent stuff. I am doing a comic thing right now for Broken Down Press. Not totally out yet, it's going to be a while. I'm not totally sure when I'm going to name it yet, so I can't really say. that's it. For me.
Is there like a
good accent?
It's like a marvelous Canadian one.
Is there a site or anything that people could find your work on?
Yep.
Silly Turtle, right?
Oh, Silly Turtle.
Oh, Silly Turtle. WordPress.com. Okay, I'm like, I know that name.
Yeah, you guys know that name.
Jackie has great business cards
today.
Are really great.
I know.
All right, so do I have to introduce myself now?
Yes, you do.
Yeah, go ahead.
My name is Alexander Thimbo, and I run Renegade Arts Entertainment. So I'm a publisher for graphic novels and comic books. I'm also a writer, and I have a background in film, so I still do bits and pieces in film. And if anybody wants to talk about business of comics,
you can talk to me.
No, it's brilliant. It's all awesome. It's lovely to be here for the first
time.
Everything is awesome in comics and books at the moment. Everything is awesome in comics and books and print.
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, you can talk now.
I can talk now.
I'll stop.
All right. I'm Erin Miller. I am the writer of Where She Walks with my brother, who does the art. I also do Panel One. That's how I remembered your. I know that name. So I'm. It's me doing the tweeting and stuff like that. And if anyone wants creator profiles, I'll zip it up on the site. Although a little slower than I'd like to be right now, but it's almost Christmas, so whatever. That's me.
When are we going to get the third issue?
Oh yeah, so talk to Nate. He's in group number 3.
We better be doing pages right now.
Right, totally. Yeah.
To whoever's editing. Cut to Nathan explaining why issue 3 isn't out yet.
My name is Stephen Charles Rosia. I am an artist and writer of the comic book. Done short stories. My latest comics are The Man Outside the Window and Muskoka, both of which are sold out and out of print, so
nice.
You'll never see them again.
and off to eBay I go.
And God knows what's happening in 2016, so we'll see. You can find my work at www.withoutatitle.com.
Okay. I'm Lee Jeffrey. I'm an artist and illustrator for the indie comic Fantasy Killer. Other than that, I just do a lot of drawing and a lot of reading and avoiding people. And right now I'm really nervous because I don't like talking out loud a lot. So I can hear myself rambling, so that's good. I'm going to do an accent now.
Wait till you hear it after.
Oh, like, God.
No, it's fine. It's totally fine.
I'm just going to avoid it.
You're also hearing everyone else and you're remembering how good a time you had.
Okay. That's it.
I'm Jason Memel. I'm the writer and publisher of Fight Comics. So I do all the writing, but none of the drawing, and I've also done a few little mini issues or parts of anthologies in the past, and kind of collecting all of those on my website at fightcomics.ca. I also produce theater. That's my day job. Yeah.
Well, we've got an interesting mix of folks who are monetizing their own comics, with the exception of Alexander, who is helping other people monetize their creator-owned comics, though. So what is your biggest challenge on the business side of making comics?
On the business side, fronting costs. It is very difficult to, one, if you're working collaboratively with other creators, paying them what they're due, because obviously artists deserve to get paid, but also printing and distributing comics is very difficult, and for somebody of independent means like myself, creating it is the first step, but then actually being able to put it out there is fairly daunting, because printing is very expensive, and printing in small batches is becoming more expensive because there's nowhere to do it in Canada at the moment. Nowhere that I know of. So the almighty dollar is kind of dictating what's happening there.
So when you say nowhere in Canada, though, you mean like nowhere like Print Ninja?
Yeah.
Or like one of those really discounted...
The more print-on-demand sort of companies.
Have you tried PageMaster and Edmonton?
No. What kind of...
Don't ask me for numbers. I don't remember. I can't remember.
But they do print-on-demand.
Jeff Martin does theirs. He does small print runs of his hit comics and the Hockey Apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
He does 150 to 200 at a time, and he's able to do it at a price point that when he sells them at conventions or online, he's happy. So I guess he must be doing it for at least 50, if not 60% off cover price.
Interesting.
Huh. In small numbers. But you have to work with their format. I know they have an odd page sizes for the economy to work, and it didn't work for us
right. With
what we were doing. So. If you're willing to work within their constraints, I think they're a good option. Mm-hmm. And they're Alberta.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, it's often been... I think you said we were all monetizing our product. I would say more like we are defraying our debt. but, I mean, for me, that I think was always kind of understood going in, that, like, that... with Fight Comics, that it wasn't like if it ever makes money, I will be happy. But the plan was never specifically for it to be a profitable product. It was more about releasing a product and having a product that I could then be in the industry with, if that makes sense. At least, like, here's a thing that I can do. I'm not just saying I have the possibility of crafting work. Here's work. And so, in that respect, like, it was my equivalent of paying. Money to do like a comics, a comics post-secondary course where you do a final thesis and you get something at the end, kind of thing. That was sort of that's how I approached Fight Comics. So some of the other ideas that I'm pursuing now, I'm interested in maybe not starting from a debt position, and I'm still working on that. But I mean, yeah, I think it's. I guess my main point here is that, like, for me, the idea of the. I've tried to be very clear about what my business strategies were, and that at my level, the idea of specifically making a profitable comic might not have been the best first strategy, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for us, it was a lot about just making the work as well. Yeah, if it makes money at any point, it would be lovely, but it's about doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what's the back? What's the backstory on Renegade?
You must know the backstory. Everybody knows the backstory.
but my listeners may not.
We're working on a movie in England when I used to live in England. Probably 8 years ago now. We're doing an anime CGI movie. And after work in the pub, we'd all get together, and I was brought on board as a producer to try and help find a missing £250,000, so about $500,000 had gone missing out of the budget. So Tony Luke, the director, asked me to come and help. And I already knew Doug Bradley, who was one of the voiceover artists, the actor from the Hellraiser films, and he was a producer as well. And Alan Grant was a scriptwriter, who's, anybody doesn't know, is one of the most successful comic book writers of all time. And we get together in the pub after work and tell stories. And they often revolved around what we'd loved in movies and comic books, classic literature, and also horror stories about how things we love have been screwed over. From my experiences in film, where you can spend a year working on a movie, and just because of someone who's involved in financing has signed the wrong piece of paperwork or screwed up their math, the whole thing comes crashing down before you actually finish the film, which had happened on a lot of projects. To Doug's passion projects being screwed around, to Alan having to rewrite whole characters at DC and other places based on what the marketing department were doing, editorial. So we decided to start Renegade as a safe haven for our passion projects and the things that we really, really wanted to make sure didn't get screwed around. Whether it was a movie or a comic book or an audiobook, like Doug's big thing was the best audiobook versions of his favorite classic horror stories, Edgar Allan Poe, Charles Dickens, etc. And then Tony was going to look after comics because he was a comic book artist at the time, but he got ill. And then Alan Grant got ill, so I ended up taking over the publishing side of it. And before I knew it, I was living in Canada and had taken Renegade with me, because nobody else in the company wanted to do the business side of it. They loved the creative stuff, but not the business stuff. And I quite like the challenge of creative meets business. I think that came from when I was learning film at college. Part of what we were doing was the finance of film. And it was, okay, you're going to go into a creative career. On paper, let's project what's going to happen to your company over the next 3 or 4 years. So film production, corporate production, commercials, music videos, being an actor, whatever your chosen route is, let's see, realistically, what's going to happen. So you do best case scenario and you're doing brilliantly and you're earning huge amounts of money and the best projects are coming in. Then middle of the road, you're getting some of the work and at that point you realize you're not making enough money to pay your bills and you go bust. So you don't even bother with worst case scenario where you don't get the work. But when you realize, no matter how many companies you set up, when you look at the realistic figures, you fail on every single one of them. It's a really good lesson in what you're getting yourself into when you start doing a creative project, because it's not like you're selling widgets that people need, you're selling something that people might want. So that's come in handy with having to run Renegade, where every project we start is a debt position, and I look at it as being a debt position for 3 to 5 years and figuring out how to cash flow without going bust. Part of the challenge in publishing.
That's interesting.
Fun challenge.
So what I was saying there about starting from a debt position is like, that's the default mode.
Well, if you get your money from Kickstarter or something, then you're in a good position. But for publishing, yeah, you can't pre-sell something usually unless you've got a best-selling author up front and you're saying, in a year, this book will be available, pre-buy it now. Because why would you? Most people will say, well, no, we'll get it in the stores once we know the book's going to be finished on time and all the stuff is ready.
Yeah, and once I've heard from other people that it might be good.
Well, yeah, from a public point of view, yeah. But the retailers quite often, like, Indigo Chapters are buying 6 to 9 months in advance now, so they're buying off like the catalogue we've got now is being presented, and they're looking at those pages going, okay, I have faith that this is going to happen, we'll put some on the shelves. And then it moves to the next stage of us trying to get the media to pay attention, and then to get people like yourselves to go, I want to buy it. Right. We've got books on shelves all over the country, but people don't know they're there. They're just going to come back to us at the end of the year. And then we cry. Returns suck.
So is Stephen the only one here that's done a crowdfunding so far?
I've always relied on grants so far.
That's interesting.
Oh, wow. That's a great.
Yeah.
accent?
Our American listeners, I can't even explain what she's talking about.
Money.
Remember the National Endowments of the Arts, which your parents said was so awful.
But I mean, and we're kind of going on a tangent here, but because I work in theater, I also receive grants. And yeah, they can be a really great way for the province or the nation to invest in the arts of their culture. And then the flip side is, not unlike Kickstarter, you do have to indicate what kind of project you're going to create. But it does, instead of trying to convince somebody to pre-buy something, you're making a case for the cultural value of what you're creating, which is, I think,
a challenge,
but also maybe. But you're not selling at the same way that Kickstarter has to sell a product.
Kickstarter almost works more as a pre-sale. Now, depending on specifically the project you're running, comics, it seems to be more of that case. There are very few comic Kickstarters that I've seen successfully, anyways, run one where they're running a service where they're not providing the product upon completion of the project. So yeah, it works more on a pre-sale model.
Yeah, and that gap is getting narrower of when the Kickstarter or crowdfunding of some sort closes and when you get that product. You're seeing very few that are, we haven't drawn a page, we really want to do this. You'll see it in a year and a half.
It's more like we're three quarters done. You know, we need you to help pay for coloring and printing, basically.
Yeah, there was a musician that that eventually you'll hear it on the show, who has held his crowdfunding back for 6 months so he could record half the album before he launches the project. Go ahead. Tangents are welcome.
Well, this is just onto the Kickstarter thing, and we were talking about debt versus Kickstarter. I have an article bookmarked that I've not read yet, but the title was that Kickstarter is not revenue, it's deferred debt.
I am buying more books than I ever had.
So, because generally, with all of the Kickstarter rewards are usually a thing you have to produce or do, work you have to do, so that all you're doing is you're getting the money in anticipation of the thing that you need to give them. So in that respect, it's not straight revenue that you can then apply anywhere.
No,
it's all very tailored. So I think that was kind of an interesting point, that it's still restricted funds in a way.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's not. Because if you do not do your project and you go, you know what, guys, can't do it, the money doesn't come back to anybody.
No,
you've got 20 grand in your pocket and you're just like, sorry, guys.
Is there no penalty for that?
No,
you just get to keep it.
There have been projects that have raised phenomenal amounts of money where the people afterwards have been brought to recourse.
I was going to say, is that
right.
Not fraud?
It's a more recent thing, but there didn't used to be a recourse.
Yeah. It looks like fraud has happened, then they're starting to investigate, aren't they? There's a couple of big ones in America. Pursuing. But for $10,000? If it breaks your brain doing it, then we take the risk as buyers. Mm-hmm. And it's like one of those things. You're just like, well, it didn't work out, but we hoped it would.
The interesting thing, too, with Kickstarter as it relates to intellectual property issues versus, like, if I'm kickstarting a thermostat or a hoverboard or something like that, and I get my hoverboard, or I get, my name engraved on the side of the building, or whatever the reward level is, if I kickstart a comic book, but then that comic book then turns into a movie, or what have you, and then those creators are now seeing this huge possible revenue from their work that we invested in. At the moment, there's no recourse. But
you're not investing in the work. You're giving them money to help them do whatever they're doing.
Yes.
It's not investment model.
It's not at all. No, and I know that.
There is a crowdfunding platform that does work on an investment model. I can't remember what it's called right now, but there is one that I know for sure exists.
And I think that's the
reason. I think it might be necessary to give. Pretty sure it is. All the best ones are.
Like, it's in Nigeria. Send him $1,000 to set it up.
Can
Can you also do email me?
No, and I know that it's not an investment model, but I think what's interesting is that, like, not unlike the same issue of people taking the money and running, is that we might start running into fans or patrons of Kickstarter starting to feel like they have more ownership of the product, even though it's not an investment, because they helped kickstart it. You know, legally they don't at all. I'm just saying it's something that I can see.
I'm saying the fans might be grumpy about the direction a character takes in a comic book.
That they might
never
feel.
Happens,
they might in fact feel entitled.
They might moan about it online somehow.
Possibly. It's unheard of.
Take to social media with their outrage.
Well, let's move into social media. So, I mean, the past year we've had a few kind of big in the industry online kerfuffles. We have access to creators in a more direct way than has ever happened. We have it in a speed that has never happened. You know, if there was a problem with the direction of Spider-Man 35 years ago, it would be 3 months before anyone knew about it. Because the book would have to cycle through, and then the letters would have to come in by snap, by old-fashioned good old mail. And before anyone knew that there was a, you'd be 3 or 4 issues past it by the time anyone knew there was upset. Now, some of you are in the online world. Some of you are putting work into the world. How do you deal with criticism from the outside like that? That's unfiltered.
No one's ever in that part. This didn't
I don't think anybody cares enough about anything I do to be mad at me for doing it.
Yeah.
Well, you just have to remember people are entitled to their opinion.
Sure.
It doesn't mean you have to agree with it.
I like to pretend that they're like I've had some stuff, so like I do some fan art, so I get people angry about some things and they'll tweet me or whatever. I just pretend that they're just some sort of troll in their basement, and I just completely ignore them, or, you know, like,
you might not be pretending.
Yeah. No, well, yeah, that's true.
I think you hit the nail right on the head. Yeah. I mean, and you're right, they are entitled to their opinion, absolutely. You can say whatever it is you want to say.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that on the other end the creator needs to listen, or that the creator has any obligation to take what you're saying to heart. Right.
And those kind of criticisms hurt. And they make you cry a little bit.
Aww.
Get angry.
Drink wine.
You're very sad today.
It's a late night.
We'll do a comic book version of mean tweets.
But like,
just Brian Michael Bendis looking sad.
Especially with film stuff, I remember you can get loads of praise and all the positive stuff comes in, and then you have one negative thing from somebody, and that's the thing you remember every time. And the same with comics. And all these great reviews come in, and I remember Gordon Rennie like sent me an email about one negative thing that somebody had put in one review, and it was a very small blog, and I'm like, but you had USA Today saying this is one of the best things that came out in the year, and all these things, and the one thing that that got to you was that negative little thing from this guy that had been read by 20 people in a month. I guess everyone's quite what's the right word, gentle.
Well, you feel like that's the honest opinion and everybody else is pumping sunshine. But there's like one person giving you an honest opinion.
Well, maybe you just want to make people happy. And there's one sad person out there. It's your fault. It's not a responsibility.
Well, now on the other side, though, isn't it wonderful that there is somebody who is so invested in your work, so invested in the film or the comic book, that they took time out of their busy schedule that they apparently have to write something negative about what you did?
They took time out of their busy schedule to hurt you.
I mean,
it was actually worth stopping.
Yeah, really,
to make
but
sure.
It's just
but I mean, the care would have had to have been there in the first place.
But the worst of it when you get criticisms that it's like, well, it didn't go the way I'd have wanted the story to go, therefore I don't like it.
Yeah.
Which is like, okay.
Well, and for those
a different story.
For those who are putting up work a page or two at a time, does that then have an impact of, I love this direction, but you know that that person's isn't gonna like 2 pages from now?
We've been very lucky so far. All of our comments have been very positive, and going back to what we were saying before, it's more like, where's the next one? speaking of busy schedules, so we've been very lucky with that. But I honestly don't know what I would say or do if I ever saw it. I'd be like, okay, well,
Well, there's the,
yeah. Okay.
I think somebody told me something in theater once that your audience doesn't like when your audience tells you something. You should listen to what they're saying because what they're feeling is authentic. But why they think it's wrong or what they think you should do to fix it is very rarely correct.
Right.
And it could be that what you want them to feel is what they are feeling, even though they don't like that, you know. So I think there's also something like I think there's an internal honesty that has to happen. You're like, yeah, that was actually kind of a
Feedback is essential.
Yeah,
absolutely. But if it's useless to me, if it's just something that's like cutting down my work or my brother's work or whatever, that's not any good to me. I can't learn anything.
Yeah, like if somebody says we hate Where She Walks because it's indie,
right?
You know, and that's their reason for criticizing it. You're like, well,
yep. So sorry,
you don't want what we're selling.
And it's not a good match, and that's fine.
Exactly.
But if it's something I can use, please, absolutely. I would love, you know, I love to learn and grow the product. Project.
I started with monetize to put you into.
I know you did. I'm like talking like all weird. Yeah, no.
So
but
how do you market your brand?
No. Right. No, God. Slowly.
All right. I think we're going to wrap up this cycle in just a minute or so. But I want a definition. This is something we've argued about on the show several times. That those of us who host the show have a difference of opinion. What is the definition of an independent comic?
It's an uphill battle.
Oh.
What's in that definition? What isn't?
Okay.
Why do you argue over that?
That's a great question.
Usually the dividing line is image comics.
Okay.
Because they are large, they have a big distribution, they have a lot of brand equity, but they don't own anything, and they don't have an editorial staff. So they have a process for how a comic gets to them, but they don't have a process for what's necessarily in that comic once it's running. They publish everything from Saga to Sex Criminals to Peter Panzerhouse.
So for you, independent implies...
Well, don't go with my definition. I want to hear everyone else's definition.
Creator-owned. Well, creator-owned and also without editorial control.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I would say, yeah, like the creator is doing the work, all the work from start to
end. Well, then what about companies like Renegade or Boom or IDW who have editorial staff but are...
But sure you are.
Creative.
I don't know. I guess maybe I consider independent to also be smaller. Like small business, right? Small... very focused, very local.
Yeah.
Right, I don't know.
For me, I would say like it's the same way I usually define independent versus professional theater. Is like independent theater usually sees their money on the back end if at all, and professional theater is usually has the financing ahead of time. And so I would call a professional comics publisher or what have you to be somebody who's prepaying their artists to create that work. And independent are those who are essentially either paying themselves or getting paid on the back end.
So you're going from not necessarily control, but page rate versus...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think editorial control is and creator ownership, like those are... other issues as well, like they're all kind of tied into it. But if we're trying to define independent versus whatever's non-independent, that to me would be like that would be my dividing line.
I would say a lot of times when independent comics or indie comics, it'd be something that's not necessarily popular, underground, harder to find, and more challenging than current mainstream comics. I wouldn't even qualify it as they get more money, so they're more professional. Or an actual like mainstream comic. It's like I don't think that's true.
Not even more money, but just money first.
Money first. Yeah. You can still get money first for an independent comic.
That's true. Yeah,
like,
yeah, that's true.
Depends.
You're getting a grant.
Yeah.
Well, and not necessarily even a grant. I mean, there are cases, like Stephen mentioned, where the writer's paying the artist, so who's not getting back end.
Well, yeah, look at some of the bigger graphic novel creators that are working through mainstream publishers on some fantastic, what I call independent books. mm-hmm. but again in advance, so we can spend 2 years writing and drawing Habibi and those kind of books.
Yeah.
So we'll close with quick roundtable: Image Comics, then independent or not independent?
I'd say yes, depending. No, honestly, yes. Yeah. Like they, it's too
they
big.
They use the same model though for every comic.
Do they?
No, they actually they don't because Robert Kirkman owns everything in his line.
Well, Wicked and Divine, like the guys are talking about, they are given an advance to give them time to do the comic.
Is that Shadowline or is that Skybound? Skybound is Kirkman's, which he has a very different model than the rest.
I don't think it's either.
Mainstream.
Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there's some hidden stuff in the indicia for Image too, of the writer owns it all or share it.
And I mean, it's also possible too that Image as a company could say, we believe in this product enough that we're going to invest in it. You know, they make that decision as a as an organization. So there's nothing preventing them from doing that.
They've been doing great stuff.
Yeah. Alexander, Image, independent or not?
Yes, independent.
Aaron?
Oh my gosh. I'm going to say no.
Steve,
independent from what? I don't know. Undecided.
That's like me. You just said me, basically.
That's my favorite response.
I don't know, it's a really hard question because they don't look like an independent company, but the books that come out look like independent books.
Or can.
I have no idea. I guess. I don't know. No.
I'm going to say yes, because Walking Dead, come on,
sure.
It's the longest
running Walking
soap
Dead,
opera.
Exactly.
Well,
Walking
I must have zombies in it. How many other publishers have taken a risk on a soap opera?
Yeah.
No one else would. I mean, he shopped that book around.
Right.
And even Image thought it was a bad idea.
Didn't he sell it on the premise that the zombies were created by aliens? I heard that
there was
story.
I've heard that story. I don't know if it's apocryphal or not.
I think it's a great story. And I'm
it's a terrific story.
It.
Yeah.
I think Image is independent, but I also think Image is not really a publisher so much as it is a delivery mechanism. And so some creative teams, which are almost their own companies, and those companies are independent.
Right.
Mm.
So interesting. So what you're saying is Image might be an independent company, but then what about the creators that publish through Image?
Exactly. Like, I wouldn't necessarily call, like, Wildstorm independent, you know.
Yeah, there are different models within Image. Yes, yeah, for sure. I mean, Kirkman does. He owns all of the characters. Jim Lee always owned all the characters, mm-hmm. And then they hire people out on Patreon.
So each book is an individual business in itself.
That's a closer analogy.
So like Saga is independent, but Wildstorm is Ouvre. How do we pronounce that? Mm-hmm. Fix that in post. is not Ouvre.
Thank you.
Ouvre.
I'm Chris with We Talk Podcasts. I know most of you. I don't know all of you, so why don't we go around the table again, and then I'll throw out a topic, and we can talk some freaking comics.
Nice.
Freaking A. Ben, let's start with you. Who the hell are you?
Not Ben at all.
Not Ben at all. No, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I thought you were joking. You could
go with it. This is Jason.
Okay. Sorry, dude.
That's okay. Right. I do Fight Comics.
Yeah, Fight Comics. Okay. It's embarrassing.
That's okay.
Lee, I draw Fantasy Killer.
Stephen Charles Rosier, I draw and illustrate and write other comics.
They're going to edit this all together.
Other comics?
I do.
Is it called Other Comics?
The Man Outside the Window in Muskoka, as of right now, and some other mini stuff and whatever.
Cool. I'm Aaron Miller. I write where she wants.
My name's Jerome Sullivan. I'm from Renegade Arts Entertainment.
Okay. I started.
My name is Jackie Huskisson. I'm a comic artist, fine artist. I did stuff like Mad Magic, Sexy Town Comics, an all-women's comic anthology for Calgary female artists. That's really cool.
Sexy Town Comics?
Yeah! 18 plus!
you did that with Jillian, right?
Jillian, yeah, I was a frontrunner for that. My studio printed it.
Okay, I've got that book.
Oh, did you? Yeah, cool. I did other stuff like a webcomic called The Inner Core. Right now I'm doing a combination comic in the UK called Benyuk. It's a bad Russian name for issue one. We're trying to get artists together, so maybe do a call up Twitter thing.
Of course.
Yeah. And right now I'm just doing my MFA in Belfast, Ireland. So yeah, that's me.
I love it.
A way better description than before.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to reuse a question I did on my last group session, and I'm hoping the answers will be different because they all got it wrong. Comics are a weird industry. As a kid growing up, I always assumed comic book writers were millionaires. Now, this I found out is probably not true. So how do you guys define success? What is success in this medium?
What were the wrong answers you got
before? Not millionaire.
Not millionaire, yes.
If you don't want to be a millionaire, you're not a success. So there you go.
I think
The right answer was work for Marvel.
Is that your right answer?
No, not really.
I think it really depends on the person, because it's such an artistic medium that it could be any level of achievement, like, oh, ever just doing it, that could be a success, being happy with your work, or to one person it could be, if you got published somewhere, that could be seen as a success. So I think it's a personal reflection overall. Like, it was probably not a true answer ever.
I think if you're sitting at a table like this and your name gets brought up and everybody goes, oh!
Yeah, it's true. That could be success too.
Then you're a success, right?
Success is relative.
Yeah.
Like Schrodinger's cat of success.
Yeah.
I have a pretty, this is a big question for me. It's been like throughout my whole life, what is success? I think we need to define it for ourselves. And I think we need to embrace our own definition of success. If we're going to be able to do anything creatively without feeling terrible stress and terrible pressure and terrible, you know, we can't let other people define it for us, right? So for anyone who's just shooting to, you know, the only way that they will succeed is if they work for Marvel. Well, that may or may not happen, but that doesn't mean that you haven't had success and accomplishments along the way. I think far too many people undermine their own accomplishments because they allow other people to define success for them. So, that's my word on success.
Wow, that took us 40 minutes before we just went around the table.
You've summarized it nicely.
There you go.
I like Aaron's stuff.
I'm going with that one too.
There you go. I mean, there's so many things going on in the world. There's so many different ways to be creative. There's so many different ways to put your work out there. Success comes in many shapes and forms, and we just have to be present and notice it when it happens.
Yeah. Namaste. I think the thing is like to not confuse the industry for the career. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah.
And so that like as long as you are making comics in some capacity, you're feeling exactly what you were saying. Your own personal success. I think, yeah, you are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you choose to either live a life where you are constantly failing, right, according to your own definition, or you can change the way you look at it and embrace each accomplishment as a series of successes towards bigger and better and different and more creative things, right? I personally choose to not look at, you know, anything I've done as a failure. Just something I've done.
Well, and it's like, it's also, I don't know if it's for anybody at this table, but I mean, it's also possible for somebody who, like, so their goal is Marvel or DC, mm-hmm. like they want to draw superheroes.
Nothing wrong with that.
That's all they want to do.
Yeah.
And that's, like, that's an okay goal, and that's an okay mm-hmm. success, but that's their success,
absolutely.
Not the success.
Exactly. Yeah, no one else can define it for you. Yeah.
Isn't it also okay to not always be successful, though? In terms of, you were saying, setting those benchmarks and having your own individual success, and if you're finding failure, redefine what success is to you to find happiness. But there's value in failing.
Oh, sure. Right? Absolutely.
Speaking from personal experience, I've learned a lot more from the times that I've fallen very flat. because honestly, I'm stupid and stubborn and won't learn otherwise.
But you're willing to learn, and that's a good thing.
Absolutely.
Finding success from failure.
Well, and I think like there is something, and like, it kind of gets back to what we were talking about, like in terms of getting grants and stuff, is that it allows you the risk of creating something without it being successful in a way, because you have that.
But again, we run into the definition. What do you mean by that?
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
What do you mean by successful?
I think a glorious failure can be wonderful in terms of what it's discovered artistically. You know, whatever you've tried that maybe isn't connecting with an audience, which might be considered a version of success, mm-hmm. but because you've tried it, and either you or another creator will see that attempt and might launch something else, like something that isn't even a definable, like you can't find the genetic legacy of your idea in their work, but it operates in that ecosystem.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. A lot of times even just doing I don't know why I use that word, just doing like any kind of artwork, like painting or the prints I do, if the print or painting or drawing, whatever I'm doing, doesn't necessarily meet my own standards, I can still learn something from it, mm-hmm. or discuss something completely new I never would have thought before, so I'm trying it anyway. Mm-hmm. So in a way, being aware of failure, but at the same time, failure is not the end-all be-all kind of mindset. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
I think what we have learned to call failure is just simply when something doesn't go the way we expect it to go, mm-hmm. right? And that's not... I don't personally think that's a bad thing, right? So, you know, the word failure has a pretty negative connotation, but I feel like, you know, really, when you find those little things that you didn't expect to find, mm-hmm. that can be really exciting, and that can be really, and so maybe, yeah, that one piece, you're like, okay, well, that's not what I expected it to be, I'm going to put it here, but then I'm gonna explore this portion of it, whatever it was, right? Yeah.
So this is sort of tangentially connected in terms of medium, but so I run a festival called the Ignite Festival, that's for emerging artists, and one thing we're explicitly going to be doing in this coming year is not focusing on quality or on the assumption of that this will be a good final product by the time it's done in our festival, mm-hmm. and instead we're actually trying to promote risk and boldness. Because it might spectacularly fall flat, but they will learn something from that.
Sure.
From that.
Come to our festival. It's terrible. Is that the tagline?
No.
It might be terrible.
But it would be spectacular anyway.
Yes.
It's so terrible. It's awesome.
So terrible. Yeah. Impossible. Well, like or rather.
That can happen.
Oh yeah, those beautiful sci-fi movies.
Absolutely.
Like,
right.
Come to our festival. It's something you've never seen before.
Yeah.
It's experimental.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, in my last little round table, we got really depressed, actually. We really figured out that through the predominant comic book publishing site, Comicology, a creator is lucky to get 7 to 15 cents per dollar on their product. Now, I move over here, everyone seems much happier, and everyone here also seems to have a different perspective on things, because I know, Aaron, you're pay as you go. We've got a comic book freaking publisher. We've got a Kickstarter guy over here.
I don't feel comfortable representing Kickstarter. Well, he did okay. I still try to deliver on that.
Okay.
Were they saying that they get 7 cents from Comixology sales based on through their publisher?
For a 99-cent comic book, I think that was after Kindle takes their cut. So I don't think we were factoring in the publisher at all.
So it's just direct creator owned.
Just creator owned. Anything under $2.99.
Yeah, but by the time you do the exchange, you get like $3.
Wow.
It's just,
yeah.
That is depressing.
But like Comixology, because we supply a number, all of our stuff goes to Comixology, and it's just straight 50-50 off the retail price.
This could have been submit. We weren't talking specific books.
Kindle's more complicated because it depends on the price that the product goes in. Your split changes from like 70% to, I forget what the other one is. Anyone remember? I don't bother looking at Kindle numbers because they're quite small compared to Comixology, which is better.
But now that 70%
of the retail price
now that they've done it, they've combined Amazon and Comixology, isn't it all one thing?
Well, Kindle's still separate.
Oh,
because we have to supply different formats.
Okay, I just buy the books.
So what's your question?
To finish off my question is for the independent guy, what is the best way to get your books into my hands? I'm the consumer.
So you tell me.
We have a meeting about that after this podcast is done.
I mean, in this day and age, does the publisher have a role?
Doing it like Rolo style.
Yeah, or you just get on Twitter and go.
That's what I would say. Probably social media campaign is probably your best bet nowadays.
It's a big part of the reason we started Panel One.
Yeah.
Mm. Right? Is to help each other do that because we are the media, right?
Mm. Or steal an email list.
Word of mouth is still the best way, I think, to discover.
A vendor outreach, like what Alpha Comics does.
Yeah,
sure. It's great for putting books in people's hands.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like going out on the streets and just giving out free coffees.
I was going
to
say free coffee.
Yeah, free coffee. No, I've been going to different cafes, bars, and just leaving parts of the comic, like a cheap-ass photocopy.
Nice.
Pages.
Oh,
and
wow.
They follow you.
Like a little a story about Jim Zub doing similarly in hotel lobbies.
I saw that happen.
That's where I heard it from.
Yeah, I think
there
I
we go. I'm telling your story.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. I was at Emerald City last year, and I saw Jim run in like with his big box and then like come in, take a big stack of Wayward and like lay it out on a table, like just spread them out, pick up what was left of the box and run, like just leave. He was in a rush.
Yeah.
And then a few people just kind of like saw him go and went like, am I supposed to take it? I'm like, yeah, you're supposed to take it. Just
go. Take it and go. Yeah.
Like I was sitting, you know, as far as I am from Aaron right now, just watching him do it. And he didn't even see me. He was at his back of me the whole time. But I was watching everyone else watch him too. So I was like, that's good marketing.
There you go.
Because everybody in that lobby probably saw his book.
I find sometimes social media can be difficult because you have to pay to use for certain premiums on your website to get better search engines. Not everyone will see your tweet. I generally only get a few retweets, not very many, so honestly I think I'm only getting like not even under the 500s.
Social media is pretty close to the people you already know on the networks that you're already a part of.
Like, I find Tumblr very inefficient now because people don't generally even, like, reblog shit or even just Instagram. So I'm finding social media becoming a dead end. And I do find word of mouth to be probably one of the best means. Groups like this is a better idea because you can spread people's ideas better.
Mm-hmm.
Going out to people and just generally giving out stuff.
There comes a point where things get too big.
Yeah.
Right? And this is kind of, I've had this conversation with a number of people over the last little while. You know, I look at people who have thousands and thousands and thousands of Twitter followers or people who follow thousands and thousands. And I'm like, how?
What benefit are you getting?
Absolutely. Yeah. What benefit are you getting following that person? What benefit are you getting being followed by that person, right? Because it's just, there's so much, right? And you just kind of get lost in this gigantic number, right? And it's,
I guess with Twitter, like,
smaller's better.
With social media, though, like, I mean, if you're looking to work in the industry and you're trying to connect with people, I guess what happens is you know, once your name gets out there and if you are following like thousands of people and they're following you back, it's not so much that you're looking at everything they do, I think. It's just, you know, the odds are that you're going to get somebody that might want to work with you or somebody that's interested in what you're doing sees you and reaches out. Most of the work that I get in, you know, both comics and graphic design are through my social media sites, people seeing my work and contacting me. Like, I don't really do local, like, this first thing I've really done locally. So I think that, you know, and when you look at some of the people that have launched these massive social media campaigns, like the Oatmeal, for instance, I mean, he just started drawing rude comics, and the next thing you know, the guy's a multimillionaire because he's...
But the guy actually used to work for Google.
So oh, did he? Oh,
yeah,
so he knew
actually,
what he was doing.
Yeah. That's why he got so popular. Yeah.
Never mind. That was...
No, I just find, well, number one, with Facebook, you... With Facebook, if you don't pay, nobody sees your crap anymore.
Right. Oh, unless true. You're yeah, unless you're doing the whole I'll follow you, follow me, and then we'll have this incestual thing happening.
Yeah.
It's like
but
if you're
Twitter's
targeting
the,
those people.
Twitter's the same way. I find it an echo chamber.
Yeah.
You get to a certain number,
yeah.
And I'm at that number right now, and I end up having the same conversations
right.
with the same people. I'm really off of Twitter.
Right.
It was something I really enjoyed until I noticed that, wait a minute, I always talk to the same 30 people, and it's really hard to find new people. I mean, you need that. Sometimes you find a magic link and you find 20 more people, mm-hmm. and you get one more into your circle, but once again, he's into your circle.
I like the analogy for Twitter that it's like having an apartment block, and your window's open, so you shout out of it. And whoever's got their window open at the time and who's in, hears you shouting and pays attention.
Yeah.
And occasionally people move in and out of the apartments. But if anybody else in the whole of the world, it's not in your apartment block at that time, doesn't have a clue what you just said.
Yeah. And honestly, I'm so tired of bots. Because I get so many artists that follow me, like, oh, follow me. Like, you follow me, I'll follow you back.
Yeah.
So like, I test it. And I'll watch them if they follow me back, and they don't. And I'm like, you guys are just little bots. Like, you're not even looking at my work. I feel like this is so ingenuous.
Yeah, there's no value.
There's no value, and it feels so mean, because it's like, oh, I love your work, but you really don't, because you're not following me.
I think this is completely unresearched, but like my instinct is that any of the social media that you're using that are generally used by everybody, so Facebook, Twitter.
Yeah.
As long as you are having a conversation, like you are talking about things that you are interested in, you are making work that you are then posting, will at the very least help. It'll be a factor of the word of mouth.
Yeah.
Like, it might not be, it won't be the thing that converts people to buy,
yeah.
but it'll be a part of what's keeping it out and about. I think, like, just generally, by doing more work versus just having more conversations.
No, you know, I totally agree. I think it's unacceptable when I see an artist without a website now, because it's like, how am I supposed to find you?
Yeah.
Or, like,
yeah.
contact you? So it's really weird to me. But at the same time, I find it strange that a lot of people are like, no, I have to rely, especially on social media, to get my artwork out. It's like, I find that such a dead end to an extent. Because you got to be lucky sometimes.
Yep.
Yeah. And it has to be a good website, too.
Yeah.
I go to so many artists' websites, and one picture.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like, look at my portfolio, and I'm like, oh, it's one image.
Yeah.
Nice portfolio.
There's no dynamic stuff going on.
Submissions for sequential comic work.
Yeah,
we get now we're about, sometimes we're getting 15 submissions a week, so we're averaging 10 to 15 a week, and it's a mix of writers and artists, and some people will send me 3 pin-ups and say that they want to do comic strip work.
Yeah.
Where's your portfolio work? Oh yeah, these are my pin-ups.
Yeah.
With no background.
There's no storytelling art to show that you can tell a story through art. I don't need that stuff on there so to prove that you're employable if you're looking for money to do your art.
I remember I was looking for an artist for the first 5 comics, and I put it in on digital webbing, I think, and I got like 50 or 60 submissions, like bam, my inbox just blew.
Wow.
But yeah, like a lot of the people, you go to their site and it was not a lot of stuff and not very good stuff, even like they hadn't even really looked at what I had said. Like, it's a 5-page black and white, and like, we're a full service art studio, we'll produce the first issue. I'm like, read the post.
Now, you didn't find Ryan through that method, did you?
Ryan Ferrier? No, actually, I found him through Ben. Through the actual Ben.
Through the actual Ben, okay. No, I just find Fight a fascinating book, because maybe it's just because we do this, and I know most of you guys now, it's like all my favorite guys guys are in that book.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
And now that it's on Comicology, I can actually read it occasionally. I got the physical copy and lost it in my collection.
Maybe that's what I should pitch. I should be like, have you already bought a copy? Did you lose it in your collection? Buy it on Comicology. That's not a, you know, now that I think about it.
There's a couple of people I know that buy physical comics, and then they put them straight on their shelves, bagged and board, and then they read it on their digital version.
They still bag and board.
Yeah, and they're doing it. They're getting a pull list every month, probably 6-7 titles, but they don't read.
Boggles my mind. Why? Like, are they protecting them?
I don't know. I never have time to have an in-depth conversation at shows. It's just people tell me this stuff.
Because horning feels good.
Because horning feels good.
Doesn't it feel good when you see your boxes? Yeah.
I agree with
no.
that.
No. I live in fear of avalanche.
You agree? Oh my god, horny feels good.
Sorry, 20 plus years of collecting comics, yeah, they stack up. And they're heavy, and I can't find anything. I find myself I'm buying digital copies of stuff I already have just to read.
You get an intern.
Sorry?
You need an intern.
Yes, I do. Do you have an intern?
Can you please
tell me?
1976
trainees.
It's somewhere in the back.
And we have people to work with us and train them up on the industry.
Have fun.
Yeah.
We're working at an intern kind of model. I don't believe in people working for nothing, so paid internship, but I've got to figure out how it works. If you're working with a small box, you need to learn to do everything across the board. And finding people that are willing to stretch their mind to jump from six different jobs over the course of the day.
You know, you might be able to find a student who's getting... either getting paid or paid his tuition to whatever to do to go to school. So he'd be working for you as part of that.
Right.
Yeah. He or she, rather. They. Anyway.
Yeah, that could be an option. We'll talk some more.
I'm sorry. I didn't know Renegade had a physical office.
No? Yeah, we have the office, and then I have a studio office set up in my house where I work for most of the time. But then there's space enough for two other people to work. So, Emily will come in and do digitization for the day, or work on sales reports, then we'll do the marketing PR campaign, and then Noriko will come in and do some stuff, whoever needs to be in there. But most people work from wherever they are in the world.
Yes.
I haven't even met half the people, or even had a phone conversation with some of the top people. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
It's all email.
Now, your company has a variety of different products they put out. How different is marketing a CD to a comic book? Is it the same process, or just trying to get the word out, getting it in stores, or
everything we do is story or story related, so it doesn't matter really what the medium is. But it's a struggle. It really is a struggle to get people to pay attention when we have so much choice for our time. And so much is free. So money isn't really the option anymore. It's time, I think. How do you persuade somebody to give you some of their time with your story? And CDs are the interesting thing about the audiobook stuff that we do is that they are the absolute reverse of graphic novels. In the graphic novels for the last 4 years have been 5% digital versus 95% print sales every year, pretty much spot on. And with the audiobooks, it's the exact opposite: 95% downloads, 5% physical CD sales, which is
just
a very good representation of how the two different markets work. Digital books and comics, I seem to have found their level.
And that level's at 5%?
Well, it is for us, with digital. I know with ebooks and pros, it's a higher percentage. I don't know what the numbers are this year, like 35% digital. But they've plateaued, and people have kind of got to their happy place. Where they want to read print stuff or digital stuff, rather than digital encroaching more into print sales. So it's a nice place to be right now for a physical print space.
Now, in your experience, do you think that your numbers would be translatable to another publisher of your size? Because your books are beautiful, and I can see. well, once you hold it in your hand, you kind of want the physical thing. Now, books that aren't quite as artist-based might not, and I'm not including writers as artists right now, which is a bad road to go down, but...
I have honestly no idea. No, because other publishers don't share.
No,
numbers.
Well, and actually, it's an interesting question, too, because like a lot of what Renegade publishes is not like... it's not like you just do sci-fi or superheroes or, you know what I mean? Like, do you find you actually market each book? Like, each book has its own strategy? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, yeah, because we're a creative-driven company. So if all of you came and worked with us on books, all the books would be so different. It's not the same thing with buying them. Although I'm seeing increasingly, especially now that there's people are going, yeah, what's the next thing you guys are doing? And they want the surprise of finding something different, which is nice. But a lot of our stuff is marketed to schools and libraries first, and then bookstores and comic stores second, and vice versa. And my astrology is comic bookstores and bookstores, and then there's a crossover to the other channels, but like this, the Arctic Comics, I forget we're doing audio only. Arctic Comics is like an anthology which is Inuit and Northern Canadian stories, and bookstores are interested, but libraries and schools is a primary market for that. Particular book. I'm still trying to figure out how we market to as many people as possible, so I'm always trying to find ideas from people at work. So if you have any good ideas, you should tell me. Please help me. But I need to go now, I realise. Because I believe the invite when you said we finished at 3:15.
It's okay, we got the wrong date on their invite. This year was really not.
So I feel bad leaving, but like all my family is at cinema waiting for
you. Yeah, waiting for you. Definitely.
So enjoy Star Wars.
Thank yes.
You. I hope so.
Nice to be with you.
And very nice to meet you. Nice to meet you people. And very nice to see everybody again. And if you're still here in a couple of hours, I can come back. Are you going to stay here and do kind of fun stuff?
I think so afterwards. I don't know for how long, but I'll send you an email.
Right.
Catch you up, don't you worry.
I'm around so I can do stuff again.
There you go. Enjoy the movie.
Thank you for doing this.
All right.
Well done.
Thank you.
Jerome signing on.
Jerome.
Now we're going to wrap up with me and then somebody else will come over. But what has been the most happy experience for each of you personally creating comics? A surprise you got at a con, somebody you met, maybe the work was just came out so much better than you thought it did. It would. Was there a point where you found that you, yes, this is why I did do it? What pleased you in the last year or so?
Is the fact that nobody's saying anything kind of a telling?
I'm just trying to get undepressed from finding out these numbers.
I think. Oops, sorry, go ahead.
I had two. I think two things that happened. One was like I think some of the stories in both anthologies I'm happy with. Like I still appreciate their structure. I feel good about that product. So that was probably those are happy moments for me. But then I also had an effect. I think it was at Alpha. And one of the regulars there, who I think also works there occasionally, told me that because of Fight Comics, he felt comfortable trying to make his own comics. He felt like it was okay to try. And that made me feel really good, because then I was, yeah, somebody might make something because I said something. So, yeah.
Nice. That's cool.
Yeah.
For us, I know that because we do the pay what you want, pay what you can model, we've had a couple times where people have, one in particular, at the Red and White Club, one gentleman, and we literally will take, like, we've taken 50 cents, right? The whole idea is that we want you to have the book, we want you to have the story and enjoy it, and whatever, and this guy, I think he had a toonie on him or something at that point in the day, and he bought the book, and thank you very much, and that's awesome. He took his kids home, read it, drove back, and gave us more money. afterwards because he, and that has happened a couple of times, right? Also at Expo, one girl did the same thing. She came back the next day and she was like, no, and it's not the money. It's just the fact that clearly what they read and what they saw moved them somehow, right? To come back and to, that has always felt really good. And when you see people come back, it's kind of an ongoing theme right now with Where She Walks is, you know, when is the next one coming? So this past Expo, we didn't have, our website got hacked and there was all kinds of drama, so we didn't do a print copy while we got the website back on track, but the number of people that came and said, where is the next one? Where is the next one? That feels really good. That feels really good. A lot of it has to do
with... I really liked, the biggest thing was when I got into my MFA program, because it's heavily concept-based, like fine art, that my teachers are so enthralled with the idea of me actually doing comics. Because it's really unheard of in the fine art world. Like, they're like, they hate comics so much. So I love that when I was able to go into the program, that they took my comics, like, seriously. And, yeah, that's probably my happiest moment this year. So.
I guess I don't know. I don't know. I guess you know you grow up like seeing comics and reading them and like I you know thought the creators were millionaires too. I assumed that they were, and I always felt like being involved in comics was very unattainable, and it was something that I wanted to do, but I didn't have any idea how to do. And so, for me, the happiest moment for me was the first time I had the book actually in my hand. I had been a part of creating that, and so, you know, opening it and looking through it was very emotional because it was like I actually did that.
I made it.
Yeah. This is. I'm like, I can be part of that. Yeah.
For me, I think there's two parts to the happiness. And then leading up to the happiest moment of this year, I guess, for me in comics. One is that base level of happiness. Me going to my regular day job, pretending to be super happy, secretly being just like, that's what I gotta do to pay the bills, and then coming home and doing it and realizing it's such a better alternative, even though financially it's not doing anything for me right now. So that's sort of the base level, and I'm happy every night when I get to come home and do that. But then the other part is, and despite what I may think about my own work, I have a few individuals now, because now that I've produced more than one book, are coming back looking for the second piece of work because they enjoyed the first one. For instance, a gentleman who sought out my Kickstarter campaign that I ran earlier this year, who pledged and left me a note saying, I really enjoyed the Man Outside the Window. So I want to support your next project and read that, and I'm really excited to be a part of that. And he's a gentleman who I must have sold this comic to in Winnipeg, and I feel bad for saying that. I don't remember him, but I see so many people. And he either follows me online or wherever, or he just happened to look at my website the day that the announcement went up, or whatever the case was. But he went out of his way to seek out the next thing I was doing and to be a part of that. So that was a happy moment for me.
Alrighty, last question. How can people give you money? Let's go around the table. Hawk your shit.
I take check, send money order, e-transfer is great.
Credit card.
Yeah. Credit card. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Over the phone to me.
E-transfer.
So for me, you can read all my books online at fightcomics.ca, but there's also links there if you do want to purchase them through, I think, both print on demand and Comixology.
Check out my website, osillyturtle.wordpress.com. You can check out my comics and buy some stuff.
The comic is always and always will be free to read online at www.whereshewalks.ca. We're also in some local shops like Phoenix in Inglewood, Elf Comics, Another Dimension, and of course you can always just get in touch with us through the website, and we'll mail you a copy, whatever you want. We're flexible.
My two latest comics, Man Outside the Window and Muskoka, are both available on my website for digital purchase at www.withoutatitle.com. Printed copies, there should still be some in alpha, depending on when you're listening to this. Other than that, that's all I got for now.
Okay, you can go to my website, leejeffery.com, and it's L-E-I-G-H, and it's J-E-F-F-E-R-Y for some reason. Or you can buy the comic book directly from handsomedevilcomics.com.
We're starting now, so we had, I'm going to go around the table here one more time. This group is with
Jason Memel, who writes and publishes Fight Comics.
Lee Jeffery, who draws for Fantasy Killer.
Stephen Charles Rosia, who writes and illustrates The Man Outside the Window at Muskoka.
Sure, we all chose the third person. I'm Erin Miller. I write Where She Walks.
and the heart and soul.
Panel one. Yes, the heart and soul. Well,
the heart and soul.
At least the Twitter voice, anyway.
At least the Twitter voice.
And Chloe Smith, comic book enthusiast and expert community builder.
Nice.
Twig Communications.
Twig Communications.
Yes. But you are the non-comic book reader here, so let's start with you. No. Because I'm sure you've seen, like Avengers. I'm sure you've seen, probably seen Walking Dead.
Yeah.
You've probably watched Hellboy, Sin City, Scott Pilgrim Saves or Versus the World.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Comic books. When you're done with any of these things, does it ever occur to you to think about looking at where they came from and think, oh, that was a cool story, that's actually really cool? Or is it just, that's it, I leave the theater or the show turns off? And if you don't ever think about it, what if they were to actually sit there and say, this month in Avengers, or this month this issue of Walking Dead, this storyline for Rick Grimes is going on, would that at all entice you? Because they don't do that.
No, they don't.
Well, they do in movies. Like, when I sit down and watch Avengers, I know that it's Marvel. So, but yeah, I would agree with you in terms of The Walking Dead. Like, I didn't know it was a comic book when I first started watching it. And when all my friends kept telling me, oh yeah, you know, now it's not following the storyline, I got interested, but the barrier to going up and picking up that comic book, or the barrier of me going online and finding that and being right in finding what I'm finding, is probably what prevented me from doing that.
The barrier. Interesting. Anybody have any thoughts on that, on the barrier?
Oh yeah. Well, I remember talking to somebody about comics. So I was talking to her husband, who loves comics, and he was talking to me about comics because he knows I make them and I'm involved, and the banter's happening back and forth. And then at one point I mentioned to his wife, I'm like, so do you read them too? And she goes, oh no, I don't have time to do the homework. And I was like, what do you mean? And she goes, well, I don't know who these characters are, I don't know all this stuff, so I feel like I need to do the homework. And I'm like, well, you know, there's books out there that you could probably read in a day and be caught up. You know, it's... And so, yeah, so in terms of barriers, for her, the implication is that anything that is a comic book is something that she needs to know 80 years of history to appreciate.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, we've talked about the issue of accessibility before, and it's unfortunate that people feel like they have to do the homework, right? Because these are ongoing stories, right? No one of them is actually complete, right? So you could just jump in at any point, really. I mean, Walking Dead, maybe not so much, you know, and there is continuity, absolutely. But if you're okay with, you know, finding your way and discovering things, maybe not in a linear fashion, then it's not so scary.
You know, actually, sorry, before I have an idea that I want to let everybody else talk before I jump into a thought.
Well, okay, I don't know. Go ahead, Jason. I don't think anybody else is, yeah.
Well, so what's interesting about the notion of homework, mm-hmm. about the notion of like that these are, that for the dominant form of the industry, which has been superhero comics, this whole notion of a continuing story was a business model that was created or like really coined between like the 30s and the 50s. And that's where, in a lot of ways, the mindset of how these stories are told hasn't changed since then. Maybe our ideas for stories have changed, like what the stories are about have changed, but the basic model of the continuing narrative in a consistent world, the selling feature of the book is not specifically what they're saying, but the fact that it's continuing to say it is kind of been the thing. But anyway, I think what's interesting is that that is not something that is built into words and pictures combined as a medium.
No.
It's a business model.
Yeah, for certain stories, for certain characters.
And it just happens to be a business model that became the dominant representation of the art form. So there's something like... Pardon me?
For a time.
For a time. I think
that is definitely changing. As a comic book reader, I'm the guy... I am one of the guys who say, I don't want to do that homework, and we've had this conversation before, where I don't pick up a lot of Capes and Tights books because I don't want to do the homework. I don't want to go back and feel like I'm missing out on the 10 inside jokes that I'm certain are in every single book, because I don't know the history. And yet, I know, because I'm on the in, that there are books outside of, we'll just say Marvel and DC, that are much more accessible because the history is a lot shorter. I can go in, even some of the larger books, you know, we're only at 27 volumes or whatever, right? That is far easier to jump in as opposed to 80 years. But I don't think people on the outside or the people looking at the comic book industry from the outside realize that, because that is the dominant presentation.
Let's ask someone outside the industry. So it's not the idea that you are, it's not the idea of holding the comic book or reading the comic book, it's the idea of not knowing where the hell to start. Is that correct?
It's the idea that if I start, I'm not going to be at the same space my friends are at who are already making those jokes like you mentioned. And I'm going to have to do all that extra effort in order for me to get those 10 inside jokes and be at that level. Almost exactly how you said it. So that would be my, I guess, barrier to picking it up. Yeah,
sure. Barrier. So, and what about the idea of going into a store? Is it like a comic book store itself? Is that unappealing? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm a closet nerd. Maybe not so much closet anymore. But,
you're on the internet now, sweetie.
Yeah, right. But I am definitely like, I really enjoy the atmosphere of a comic book store, the same as I do a record store.
Have you been to the Calgary Comic Con?
No, I have not. But I've been to Kamikaze.
Okay.
And I feel out of place because I don't know where to start, because it is an overwhelming environment.
It is, and there's so many books, but there are also every month new books, new number ones to come out, and good books. And but is it the staff that doesn't do a good enough job of telling you, helping somebody start? Is that up to the staff? Is that up to creators? Is that internet? Whose responsibility is it to get more people reading comics?
I think that's the internet.
Is it?
Sorry, Jason.
No, that's okay. I think the internet is a great place to start, because then you can find the books that you're interested in. Well, but here's, I guess, the again, talking about legacy systems, and in a lot of ways, I feel like so much of the industry or the infrastructure that we're in is predicated on an older structure that it would be interesting to see what would happen if we left it behind or moved on from it. Because when you go into a comic book store, you're not seeing all the mystery books together and the science fiction books together and the action books together and the espionage books together. You're seeing Marvel and DC. And maybe you're seeing the X-Men together and the Avengers together. You know, so there is some grouping. But that if you're just looking for a story, you're like, I feel like a spy story.
Mm-hmm.
The comic book store is not going to help you. I mean, an agent in that store might be able to help you. In fact, they
because those stories exist. I mean, if you whatever genre you want, whatever you like, there's a good comic book out there of it.
Yeah, but the way it's structured, like, and I'm sure the staff will probably help you. I think, but when you walk in, it's not you might not even feel like it, the capacity to ask the question is there because the division hasn't happened. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and you know what? It makes me think I want to retract my initial statement of where should it start on the web. It needs to start with, and forgive the common term here, but like a comic book ambassador. Mm-hmm. Like the reason why I go to, I can't remember the name, the big game store down in Sunnyside, is because my father used to bring me there to find little figurines for me to paint as a kid, right? And then I went back there because, you know, my partner is like, you know, they have $5 games and we can rent games. So now we rent games almost every week. That's why I go there. I need the same kind of ambassador to bring me into a comic book store and say, like, this is a section that I think you'd really enjoy. Start here.
Mm. So, I mean, any one of us could probably tell you our favorite store or our favorite, but like right off the top of my head at Red Skull Comics, it's probably the fullest to the rafters kind of store. But you go in there when Kara's working, she will take care of you. You will leave with...
Go to Geek Girls Night Out.
Go to Geek Girls Night Out, which is run at, yeah, which is run at Red Skull. Kara has introduced me to several different stories that are outside, you know, standard Marvel DC, but even Marvel DC, she can tell you exactly where to jump in and that sort of thing. So Chris at Alpha is the same thing, right?
But what about the idea of web comics? Like your book's available for free online.
Yes.
So there's no barrier there.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, no, there's still, like, that's to suggest that it's online does not invalidate the problem of being lost in the haystack.
Sure, absolutely. Finding discoverability, right? Like,
discoverability.
Like we mentioned briefly in a... Alexander was mentioning that briefly in another one. So yeah, like, because there is so much, right? Yeah. So how do you find, even though it is readily available, right? If you were to Google webcomics, you wouldn't find mine, right? Because it's not technically a webcomic, even though it is... free to read online, right? Yeah. You'd find other great ones, right? But not necessarily mine. So yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah, it's a... quite often, like, especially, we don't see it as much now, but like back in when the web was webbing.
What was webbing?
There was this implication that, like, hey, I started a blog and I've got Google Ads on it and I'm going to strike a rich. You know what I mean? There was that implication that because the barriers were down, the money would start flowing in. And I think that's not really the case anymore. Like, we now know that's not the case. But, and so I think just in terms of what you were saying about an ambassador, is that, like, on the web, it's almost like... Well, and I think actually, sorry, I'm kind of rambling around here. But I think Panel One has been doing an interesting job of that because it, by being an aggregate of creators, it then starts to become an ambassador for those creators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it can reach out to a wider bank.
Are any of you familiar with the work of Robert Venditti? He writes Green Lantern and Exo Manowar. You know, so he's a very popular writer. I mean, you know, writer of one of the most 20 most popular books on the planet. You know, and he didn't read comic books coming up, and he was working in a warehouse where the guy kept on saying to him, "Read this," and he would go, "No." Read this, and go, "No." Until finally one just came to him and he went, "That I'll read." And his point to me was, when I was talking to him, was, no, there is no one way into getting people interested, is it?
No.
It's whatever it is for that person that would interest them, and you just don't know until you keep... So even an ambassador, how do they approach people? How would you be an ambassador, Lee?
Would I be one?
Yeah.
In person or online?
Mm-hmm. Whatever. Whatever. How would you get people?
I would have to do it online. So
yeah.
How
would you approach people? Yeah.
Do you talk to your friends? Like, do you talk to your friends and do you suggest?
Yeah, I suggest comics for my friends to read, I suppose, but nobody ever takes me up on it. So, and I think it's because it just, to them, it, like you said, it feels like, you know, a lot, they don't know who the characters are. It's very, they'd have to go someplace, and a lot of people actually view comic book stores to be very intimidating because they're quiet and they don't know what's going on in them. And there's a whole, you know, kind of like, I don't really know what I'm supposed to be doing in here, and am I allowed to touch them? And, you know,
I mean, Kamikaze, quite frankly, Kamikaze, they have a bunch of stuff, but it's a clusterfuck. Quite honestly, you go in there, I know comics. I can't find anything in there. Yeah. You know, so somebody who's completely, you know, new, I don't know where would they start.
I think even just a typical comic book short. Well, and I would even say alpha, being, I didn't grow up reading comic books or going to comic book shops. So even now, reading comic books and drawing and whatever. If I walk into Alpha Comics and people are having a conversation inside, usually it's the typical whatever. I feel on the out and I feel intimidated just standing in there. I can't hold a conversation. It's a good thing that we're not having those conversations over the course of this podcast because I'd be the
in
guy
Alpha Comics?
I got no idea.
Yeah. Why?
Even in, because I don't know. I'm the outsider amongst other people. Now, if we're talking about something that I do read, fine, but I don't read what everybody else is supposedly mm-hmm. reading.
There was something true to the comic book guy character in The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. He wanted to keep you outside. He didn't. Yeah. He wanted the people who were in his social.
And feeling that maybe we're that person that they don't want to sell to. You know, maybe I'm that person that doesn't know.
I completely agree. Yeah.
On the other side, when I suggest people go to, unless it's somebody who I know is very interested and very, very interested into getting into comic books and the culture of, I suggest they go to Chapters.
Yeah.
Because Chapters has a growing comic book section and whatever.
Yeah,
and it's every time I go in there, I go, oh my god, this has a better selection of the stuff I'm actually interested in than even Alpha Comics, right? But it doesn't have the same sort of intimidation because it's a bookstore, it's got a Starbucks in there, it's got, you know, it's a much more open environment. There's a different culture to a bookstore than there is to a comic book store.
Yeah, like imagine a comic book store that was like built like a Chapters. So there was some chairs to sit in. Mostly, you'd have mostly trades rather than issues because issues are intimidating right off the bat.
Yeah.
And they would be organized by genre, not by publisher. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, like, you've got your sci-fis here, you've got your...
The difficulty with that, though, is, again, from talking to some publishers that I know, it's the monthly books, though, that still carry the industry.
Depending on the publisher, if you talk to Alex, and something that I've spoken to him about, he wants to get away from individual issues because he's not finding any suggestion in monthlies. It's all trade.
But he doesn't do monthlies.
Well, and the other thing, too, it's important to recognize, like, Marvel and DC... I mean, I say this speculating, so I haven't done my research. In case I'm wrong, don't yell at me, internet.
the trolls are coming.
Yeah, the trolls are coming. I can kill them with fire. Now I lost my train of thought.
Marvel and DC.
Marvel and DC. Thank you. Their monthly books are definitely that's a lifeline for them. But it's a lifeline that they've built over 80 years. And it's a lifeline that is dwindling. Like, you go back to the 90s.
I was talking to the guy. I was talking to Matt Hawkins of Top Cow.
Yeah.
I was talking to him, and he was telling me, no, I cannot live. I was asking him about trade paperbacks. I was asking about the digital books and comiXology, and he said, no, I can't live if people aren't buying my monthly comic books. That's how we pay our bills. Everything else is break-even.
Totally.
And that's they're like the number 11 publisher. I mean, they're technically part of Image. But,
right. But, you know, a lot of this comes down to a business model and a structure that is still predicated on that 80-year-old model.
So that's what needs to shift.
Yeah. He's definitely, I'm sure Matt is correct in what he's saying, but that's because his model and his cash flow and his strategies are all predicated and aiming in that direction. Mm-hmm. What's his name? Polarizing figure, self-publisher.
Polarizing figure.
Dave Sim.
Dave Sim. I'll introduce you to Dave Sim's polarizing views some other time.
Yeah. let's save that. That's a whole separate.
That's a whole other podcast.
So, his views aside, he had some interesting. Like, he was a really good self-publisher.
Yes.
And he made a point of saying. So he had one book that he put out monthly, but as soon as he got to like a certain number of each book, he then released them as trade paperbacks, and he relied on his trade paperbacks.
The phone books were huge for him.
Yeah, because they kept going. Every time somebody discovered his book Cerebus on the shelves, they could go and catch up to the whole thing immediately. And in fact, like myself, as a fan when I first started reading it, I would wait for those trades because I appreciated that. And I think
but he's essentially, he was only publishing, I mean, he did have a period where he was publishing Flaming Carrot and his other books, but essentially he's only publishing his own books, and that's easier to do than theoretically if you're trying to publish 5-10 books a month. I think that's more difficult.
Well, yes. So, but again, so, okay, let me put it this way. If the industry, my theory is, if the industry overall could start predicating itself on selling books, almost like Netflix doing a season of Daredevil and a season consider it a season. You can still keep your element of serialization, but you're no longer asking people to show up once a week or once a month at a shop to get that, because that's a lifeline, but it's not a sustainable model overall.
Coming back to you, because you're the non-comic reader, picking the mind of a non-comic reader around a bunch of comic people, very interesting. So what about that idea? I mean, I don't know if you've seen, we talk about the single issues and you don't know where to start. If you knew that every time you're getting what they call the trade paperback, which is a collection of stories, you're getting a complete story, that's all you need. You don't need everything before. You might miss out on one or two little things, but if it's good writing, you should. That's the story all by itself. If you knew that, would that take away some of that barrier? Is it because that is generally how they are. They're writing for trade paperbacks now, especially those big two companies and Image. They're writing for trade paperbacks, but they're not properly then, I guess, telling people, hey, these trade paperbacks are, that's all you need.
Well, I like kind of like a midpoint in between having the standalone and then having the series. Because the minute you said series, Jason, I felt comfortable.
You felt comfortable?
I felt comfortable.
Okay.
So to have a book that has 13 episodes in it, mm-hmm. right? Or
issues.
Mm-hmm. Oh gosh. But like, what I mean is like, you
don't
know.
Don't be that issue.
Don't correct them. Just kidding.
No, it's okay.
But to, you know what I mean? Like 16, to have
13 shows in a book.
Yeah. So. Yeah. you're so funny. That at least gives me a sampling of what's going on, and so I can commit. And if you're gonna run for, you know, 8 segments of this,
I'm like so worried about my word choice now.
I'm sorry.
Just joking.
But if you're gonna run like that for me is more manageable than having to find the first version of what I've gotten into already, or picking something up. At least I know that, okay, if I like the first couple comics here, like, I've got this whole shelf worth, and that's okay. And that's where I can stick right now and venture out as I feel more comfortable in the space.
And it's important to recognize, too, that, like, what I'm talking about already happens. Like, for manga, that's how I work. Like, they don't do
single issue.
30 issue single. Well, they do single issues, but they're like 200 pages.
They're big,
exactly. They're huge, and they don't produce them monthly.
Some do. It's
200 pages a month. That's true.
The manga industry is actually frightening in the amount that a single artist has to produce. It's culturally acceptable for them to become more hermits than even the American comic book industry because they just have to produce so much.
That's not helping.
It's not. That's the way that the industry is. So that's a different problem.
Yes. but so from a consumer perspective, like, yeah, a consumer
it's
will...
It's great.
Yeah. Well, so sorry.
I'm a consumer, all right? And I will completely admit to that. And it is absolutely great to have it more of a concise version so that I can pick it up and just go... Mm-hmm. Go be a hermit myself.
But they don't. Yeah. So maybe they need to do a better job. It just seems like they need to do a better job of a lot of these little things. And they're not even. Are they even? Is a problem that they're not interested in getting the new people? They're just interested in selling to the current people.
They're saying they're interested in the new people.
Yeah, but I'm also interested in driving a Lamborghini tomorrow. I won't be doing
it. With the boom of comic book culture that's going on right now, as far as like you see, everybody's wearing Spider-Man socks and everything.
I don't know how many of them are actually converting into comic book fans.
The intellectual properties are extremely valuable to them through the movies and the licensing. But is the actual property that it's created by, is that what's falling behind? That's the big question.
Well, so it's like, I think ultimately it's the fact that they are still chained to that 80-year-old business model. Mm-hmm. That was what started it. That's how it was working. It made them a lot of money at one point. But it's not necessarily the most efficient model now. But because it still has a flow, it has a cash flow. Because they know that there's going to be every Wednesday they're going to see this bump. It's kind of terrifying to say we're asking you to forego a weekly bump in your cash instead to try something new.
That's right. I mean a good 60-70% of the sales come out on the day the books come out for a lot of those stores. Mm-hmm.
And it's crazy. Like it's one of the few industries that ever, like, it's one of the few arts industries that I can think of that would work in such a reader hostile fashion in terms of being able to find new readers, like, and in comic book stores. I love comic book stores, but like the invention of them when we went away from newsstands and grocery stores into a place where you had to be a fan to go in. That's kind of why we saw the implosion of our numbers that we did.
Mm-hmm. Although I really like the the exclusivity and the community feel of going to a comic book store and being able to like hang out with your buddies.
I completely agree.
That's a huge part of what was so successful about the Alpha Comics fundraiser, for example, right? Is that we had that community to build on and bring together to help Chris.
But there has been a
startup broken into, right?
And so if you want to grow your fan base, you're going to have to get at the younger readers, and the younger readers have to convince their parents to take them to a entirely separate store.
That's why chapters. I should go check out the comic book section of chapters next time.
Nobody is actually like promoting these books, right? Like, this just doesn't happen. I don't read the ads in books. I'm sorry, I don't. It's just, it's in the way of the story for me, especially the ones that are smack in the middle. I'm like, no, I keep going. But like, from a creator point of view, right? These big publishers who, sure, okay, fine, we'll take your idea. Fine, we'll publish your book.
You know, you definitely
we published your book.
Focus on a social media.
That's it.
And then you're kind of left sitting there going, okay, right? And you see that. I mean, that there's that myth of publishing in general, right? From what I've read, it happens in just regular book publishing as well, right? Everybody's interested in creating this content flow, right? And then what happens with these books that are done afterwards, right? And how do you find new readers? And I think, you know, panel one, we'll do that. Geek Girls Night Out, we'll do that. Your local comic book shop will do that. I mean, the thing is, some of them are still kind of in the dark ages of comics where, you know, they're not very welcoming, but a lot of them are, you know, and I think as consumers, we need to step up and ask the questions.
I think they're learning it, that they need to change that. I think
absolutely.
The stores, I think, do things, because, but there is, yeah, I mean, there's no doubt, like I said, the comic book guy, I mean, there's no doubt that there's been that guy in there that's like, I don't want to sell to you, I want to sell to people who are just like me. Because those are the people I can talk to.
Sure.
Those are the people I'm comfortable with.
Sure.
And at times I've gone into a store and I've somebody I've never met before, because we have this one little bond, I can talk to them forever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a cool feeling.
That is good. Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, one of the questions I have for you guys, though, is when you are recommending these books to non-readers, and this is, again, question for a non-reader, is the price an issue? Because... I mean,
for a single issue, you mean? Or
for a single issue or a trade paperback.
Okay.
Comics have gotten expensive. You know?
I bought a trade paperback this morning. That was Lazarus, by the way. You'd really like it.
You'd really like it.
It's
Greg Rucka's?
Yeah,
Greg Rucka. Yeah.
It's a I won't say from before, but it's a Christmas present. Anyway, it's, I guess this won't be done before Christmas, will it? Anyway, but it was $14.97. I think that's comfortable with that.
Yeah, $14.97. That sounds like it's not too bad.
How much time of reading?
Depends who you are.
I can eat that in about half an hour, really. Because I just
Maybe it depends on the book too. Certain books I'll sit there and really study.
Yeah, we're like junkies. We're like tap a vein.
More
and go, something
So a good example of that, something like Sandman, for example, right, which is incredibly dense, right? I mean, Neil Gaiman as the writer, and then all of the art and stuff like that, and there's 10 volumes, and it's really big, you know, really big concepts of dream and destiny and all this sort of stuff. That might take you a bit longer, but, like, Lazarus is pretty, like, it's action, it's... Not to say that it's simple or it's just a very different style story, right?
So the pace
is different. Yeah.
You were talking about Matt Hawkins earlier, and I heard a podcast with him where he was saying that comics are the worst medium, dollar for dollar, for time in terms of what you're.
Because that's what I look at is this is entertainment, and what is that worth to me? Right, like in town right now, to go play bowling, for example, I just found this out the other day. It's like
$60
right? For like an hour.
It's ridiculous.
And that's not worth that exchange. Like bowling is not $60 worth of fun. No offense.
Bowling,
that's the name of the podcast now. Bowling is not $60 worth of fun.
And like, no, but you're right.
More efficient than bowling. When you're
right?
At least in trade paperbacks.
Yes,
it's true. If you're gonna go see a movie, you're gonna pay $15 and it's gonna last 2 hours. If you're gonna read a comic book, you might then spend. If you buy a single issue, you're gonna spend $4, and you're probably gonna be done in 5 to 8 minutes.
Yeah.
So.
Yes. No, I don't know.
I think that's a barrier.
We've kind of talked about this before, and I'm.
You don't charge for your book. You just say, pay me whatever you want to pay me.
I pay what you can. Yeah.
It works.
It does work.
If she said to you, here's my book, you don't have to pay, but if you want to pay, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to decide, that's probably very enticing to a non reader, right? And that's what she does.
Some people start to invest in you.
That's
not very.
That's the genius of it. They're not investing in the book, they're investing in the person then.
Yeah, well, and I mean, and it's also, I mean, I don't know, the whole idea that there's any kind of price tag or like transaction that has to happen in order to enjoy something, I get that that's the real world, I get that that's a certain view of the world, but I personally, like, if I'm going to start dollars and censing everything I do in my life, you know, and sure there's a bit of that because we all need jobs and we all need to pay attention to that, but I mean, you could start applying that to everything, right? And it's tiresome, and I feel like that sucks a lot of the enjoyment out of it. Single issues is not going to work for everybody.
Yeah. I think, like,
trade paperbacks might.
It's not a price point. Like, the price point isn't a concern in terms of time spent consuming, but in terms of excitement gained after consuming or during consumption. So if the excitement level of reading a comic is very high, like, you're like, this was amazing.
I got my money's worth.
Even if it only took me 5 minutes. I'm on such a rush. That's a $5 rush right there.
But that doesn't happen with every book, right? I mean, and that doesn't happen with every bowling adventure. That doesn't happen with every... Right? But when you choose...
$60 bowling adventures, right?
My average bowling adventure, $27 worth of bowling.
So when you choose to be a consumer, I mean, it can be like you could pick up one single issue run and be that jazzed about it, and then you pick up another single issue run of another story, even by the same author. Sometimes you're like,
that happens with novels too. That goes for everything. I've done that with movies
and everything. Right?
Yeah, so we're also spoiled. Are we also spoiled though by the fact that Netflix is $10 and there, and that's all the movies you want? Exactly. Scribed, if you're unscribed and you get all the books and all the comic books on there, and that's $10 a month, you know. So I mean, these business models. Yeah, that changes things too. I mean, if I'm sitting there going, okay, for Unscribed, I can get there, or Marvel Unlimited, $10 a month, I can have every single Marvel book from like the 60s to the 90s. Every single one is available to me for $10 a month, or I can go and spend $5 on a single issue. It's not hard to decision to make.
The math of that is, yeah. But I mean, I don't know the
average... But even for a book, like Scribe, like it's...
Sure, but I don't think the average consumer is actually, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but interested in that much. Right? Do you know what I mean? Like with the monthly...
I just like the choice.
Yeah, sure.
That's the thing. I like the fact that I can sit there, I can open up my Scribe app, and I can go, what do I want to read? Do I want to read a Star Trek book? Do I want to read a biography?
Sure.
Do I want to read... And I'm just going to flip through them until I find whatever it is. And then a storm.
On the other end of that, it's not physical. I am not fond of reading things on a screen. It's just a preference. I've always enjoyed the feel of the page and flipping.
Well, it's actually also well documented that it's really bad for us. So
there's an experience from holding something in your hand.
Bullshit.
And actually,
that's the way I like it.
And maybe that's an artist thing.
That could be. Yeah.
So actually, I couldn't do that.
I agree with you there because books I cannot read on a screen. Mm-hmm. News I can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like news articles, fine, I'll read that online or on my phone or whatever. Some comics I read, and I'll be perfectly honest with you, I am not a single issue buyer. You know, I'm not. That doesn't make me any less of a comic book fan. That doesn't make me any
maybe
less of
a little
supporter.
Less.
Maybe a little bit less. Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough.
Well, I know you're joking.
XP lost.
Yeah. I know you're joking, but that right there is exactly part of
that
the
mentality exists.
Oh, I'm just kidding.
That mentality exists. Yeah. But I mean, the thing is, there is a very it is a select group of people who do who have pull lists. Right, and who engage in that culture of every Wednesday I know where I'm going to be, and that's a choice that they make, and it's great. And you know, that doesn't make them any more or less a fan than someone who purchases the book at Chapters or at their local shop or digitally.
I don't think necessarily we I don't think we're asking for Green Lantern and Spider-Man to die so that we can have this new glorious comic.
No, of course not.
Well, that would be interesting.
I want them both dead.
But I'm sure they've died 100 times already.
That's true, yeah. I think there needs to be, or I think we could use a subset or a different way of approaching it that allows for the kind of discovery of a non-comics
Absolutely.
Reader.
Change is good, right? And a lot of people fear change, though, right? And all it takes will be one person or one group or whatever to sort of shift the dynamic, and it could be a whole new world.
Well, you know, it's funny. I've got two kids.
That was awful.
And neither one of them are comic book readers. I cannot convince them to do it because video games are essentially live-action comic books that they participate in. And
I love video games.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's all they want to do. And my son is much more he's like, I don't want to read the whole comic. I'll watch the movie. But I came home from the last comic convention and I had a copy of Wolf Hands, and it was something he'd never seen before, and it blew his damn mind.
Yeah, that's
he was like, I want all of these.
Is it just your name?
It was a character he'd never seen before.
Yes, that's right.
Well, there's a flavor too.
Wolf Hands is drawn by a good friend of ours, Nick Johnson.
Nick, yes.
It's right
and,
in that corner.
And written by Justin.
And written by Justin.
Not Jason. Yes,
Nick was bugging me about not name dropping him earlier.
No, there you go. Name drop. Yeah. There you go. Yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, I think the more people start to understand, and this will probably segue nicely into the conversation we'll have after this, but the more people understand that there is more to comics than Marvel and DC, not that doesn't take anything away from them, but I mean, for crying out loud, you can get a story about a lesbian couple engaging in BDSM, you know, and it's lovely and light and well written and beautiful love story. And you can get things like Lazarus, you can get things like Lumberjanes, you can get things like Gem and the Holograms has been rebooted as a comic book, right? I mean, there's so many different things out there. It's not all just capes and tights, and you know, although those are great as well. So,
unfortunately, we gotta wrap this part up. You guys are awesome. I've really enjoyed this whole day, but this has been, I'm going to tell you the truth, and I've said this to every single group, but this time I mean it. This is the best of the groups, without a doubt.
Oh, group number one, come on, right?
So, but any last thoughts on this topic or anything else, or anything you want to promote, Jason?
In terms of promotion, I have a play coming out about Jack Kirby, who is one of the guys who created the Avengers, the Fantastic Four, the X-Men.
This is the one written by Fred Van Lente?
Fred Van Lente is writing.
Yes, I supported it on Kickstarter. I can't wait to go and watch this movie.
Yeah,
are
this
we allowed
is
to
awesome.
Cosplay?
Sure.
To come
yes.
see the show?
Anybody who dresses as the most obscure
Kirby character?
Because he had the greatest names for characters.
So yeah, it's a play about the man who created these characters, and it's also about why most people don't know his name. And that'll be in April 13th to the 26th, I think. SageTheater.com. And for my comic stuff, mycomics.ca.
Cool.
Last thoughts or promotion or anything?
I
I don't have any last thoughts. I don't have any first thoughts.
You had a lot of really great mid thoughts, though.
Those mid thoughts were they kicked ass. Yeah.
Steven?
Oh, geez. Nothing to promote. I literally have nothing going on right now. But if you're interested in what I'm doing, you can find my website at www.withoutatitle.com. And I'm also on Twitter at Steven Rosia and Facebook by the same name.
Oh, just, they have no way of getting like Muskoka or something like that still? You can't?
It's out of print.
It's out of print?
Well, yeah, I'm just tired of it. I'm a notorious hater of my own work. By the time I was done the last page, I hated it. So, yeah, there's not going to be any more.
That's a whole other podcast, I think.
Oh, wow.
Creator self-love.
Please buy my story. I hate it all. Good.
Not the communications expert. We're going to be
sure that they will beat us.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. Going to need psychiatrists to help.
No.
Aaron.
So, yeah, Where She Walks, issue 3, chapter 2, will be out in time for Expo in April. It's late this year. Goes over last weekend of April into May. But it'll be available then. So that's what's on the go. And I guess I'll just plug something else this time too. It's www.panel1.ca to find, as we were talking about, the aggregate, the growing community that represents just a fraction of the talent in this city and in Edmonton and in Lethbridge and in Saskatoon. Somehow we kind of have spread out a little bit. So, who knows? Last year it started actually at this podcast. So this year maybe, we'll go national.
We're in a good place, but yeah. Well, no, right? Let's not go national. All right. Let's just grow the one that we have
a little bit. All right, Bo.
Yeah, completely probably off topic here, but kind of pertinent to the conversation we had. If you're interested in building a community around your company and would like to learn more about that, and invite me for coffee,
Or bowling. Or bowling,
because apparently I really like bowling. If you want to go to www.twig.comms.com, you can find out what we do there.
Awesome.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Aggressively. We all defend the role we play. Regrettably, times come to send you on your way. We've seen it all, bonfires of trust, flash floods of pain. It doesn't really matter, don't you worry, it'll all work out. No, it doesn't even matter, don't you worry, that ain't what it's all about.